If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, you're listening to the BBC History Magazine podcast. I'm Dave Musgrove, the magazine's editor.
And I'm Sue Wingrove, the deputy editor.
This is the first of our two December 2009 podcasts. Coming up in this edition...
Even fish paste is actually tins of sardines mashed up with even more tins of bully beef. So the recipes themselves probably didn't help the cooks.
That was Dr. Rachel Duffett on how there was no escape from bully beef for the rank-and-file soldiers on the Western Front during the First World War.
Yeah, he was a monarch who was seen as restoring French liberty.
And that was Professor Julian Swan talking about King Louis the 16th and the French Revolution.
This podcast is produced by the team behind BBC History Magazine, the UK's best-selling history monthly. We'll tell you how to get hold of a copy of the magazine later on.
But before we go to this month's interviews, let me tell you what's on our website at the moment. Now, whether or not you buy the magazine, there is a lot of free historical content to enjoy there. If you haven't visited it before, do take a look. There are special features to read, plus our guide to history on the TV, as well as an index to back issues of the magazine, a weekly quiz, and a forum where you can talk history. You can find all of that at www.bbchistorymagazine.com. Also, we have a series of audio guides on the website, where Julian Humphreys delves into the stories of some of Britain's historic towns. If you go to our Visit History section and click on any of the day tripper pieces there, you can hear the guides. And as a taster, here's a clip from the guide to the North Wales town of Conwy.
Now, many of the so-called dungeons that you find in Britain's castles were, in fact, little more than cellars and storerooms. But that's not the case here. The upper floors of the tower were clearly built for comfort. They got fireplaces and window seats, but there's no doubting what the lower level was used for. Note how the doorway is set about 4 feet above the floor level, and how the drawbar halls were on the outside of where the door would have been. Proof that the door was intended not to keep people out, but to keep people in.
So to listen to that in full, go to www.bbchistorymagazine.com/visit/Conwy.
Now, it's commonly said that an army marches on its stomach, and in our December issue, Dr. Rachel Duffett of the University of Essex writes about British Army food on the Western Front during the First World War. She specialises in the social and cultural impact of war in the 20th century. I spoke to her earlier. Rachel, you have a particular interest in what life was like for the rank and file soldier during wartime. Can you tell me, why was food such an important issue for the average Tommy?
Well, I think you'd probably say it's important to all of us. For soldiers who were exposed in the front line on the Western Front, then food was a very important source of comfort to them, not just physiologically, but also the connection with home through the parcels And also, it was evidence of the army's care or the value that the army placed on the men that they'd conscripted or forced to join the ranks. So, yes, it was central to the soldiers' existence.
Okay, and what was the supply system like? Did the soldiers actually get enough food?
Well, it's hard to tell because a lot of the official army records relating to food haven't survived. I don't think they were regarded as important as, say, the battle diaries and other such information from the war. So what I've looked at in my research is the soldiers' own accounts, their diaries, their letters and their memoirs. And I suppose unsurprisingly, perhaps, the soldiers are a lot less enthusiastic about the food and the quantities they received than the official army line is. I mean, clearly it's a very complex thing to try and supply such vast numbers of men. And if we think that on the Western Front in March 1918, there were just over 1.8 million serving soldiers. So supply was a problem for the army. And I think to give them credit, they worked very hard to introduce procedures that at least did the best they could to ensure that men received food. It was a very complex system from supply depots along the French coast. The food was then moved by train to the railheads, where it then went on to motorized lorries. But a large portion of the journey was made by horse-drawn limbers. We mustn't forget that although this is regarded as the first mechanized war, in fact, horses played a very important part, certainly in pulling not just the armaments, but the men's food supplies. And then eventually, it was generally small ration parties who'd carry the food in boxes or on sacks on their back up to the actual front line.
Okay, so it was a really complex and skilled operation to actually get the food to the cooks. What sort of things would they prepare for the soldiers on active duty?
Quite often men in the front line would be doing their own cooking, if any cooking was to be done, because if you were quite close, it depends where you were in the line, obviously, but if you were close to German lines, then the possibility of getting a cook's unit up there was most unlikely because it would just attract attention, sniper fire and shelling. The cooks, army cooks, I'm afraid, don't have much of a reputation. I think one of my soldiers called them manuals, who could turn a piece of steak into leather in no time at all. I think as well, if we look at the army cookbooks, which are another source of information that I use, that some of the army recipes aren't very inspiring either. So even if the cooks were well-trained, and the army introduced an enormous training program to try and improve the level of cooking, the actual recipes themselves probably didn't offer a great deal to the men. One tends to find that bully beef, tinned corned beef, as we call it now, features in many of them. So even things that look vaguely reasonable, for example, spring soup is actually four tins of bully with stock and a few vegetables. Even fish paste is actually tins of sardines mashed up with even more tins of bully beef. So the recipes themselves probably didn't help the cooks very much in providing an interesting diet, and said certainly the men were less than enthusiastic about much of the food they received from the cooks.
And what happened at Christmas? Was there something special at Christmas?
Well, the army pulled out all the stops then. It tried very, very hard to make it a special day for the men. Obviously, if you're in a frontline unit on 25th of December, you didn't necessarily get anything different in what you ate, but you would get your Christmas dinner in a few days' time or a week later or whenever you were rotated out of the trenches. If you were lucky enough to be in the reserve lines on the 25th, then you generally got what all the soldiers regarded as a feast. Now, a lot of this would have come from the army itself trying to, as I say, to find, if you couldn't find turkeys, to find actual joints of fresh meat, but also to add nuts, even fruit, oranges. Fruit doesn't feature too much in a British Tommy's diet, but certainly at Christmas it would. Nuts, and of course Christmas puddings. The other source for those extras would have been something like the comforts funds. Most of the big battalions, or certainly I've looked at the Rifle Brigade information, they actually ran charities, basically, where women, often wives of officers, would raise money at home to buy comforts for the soldiers. And that often meant Christmas puddings. So the men would have say, something extra at Christmas. Officers would also get their wives to specifically send over food from their own kitchens. One soldier I read was very grateful for his captain's wife's mince pies, which had been made at home in Sevenoaks, and he was consuming them out on the Somme somewhere. So anything extra that could be obtained was at Christmas. And, of course, the key thing, I'm afraid, even more so perhaps than the food, was the fact there was a chance of some alcohol, and it was generally considered an officer's duty to provide beer for the men. So it didn't always happen, but that was certainly what the soldiers counted on at Christmas time. And also, of course, from their families, they'd receive enormous volume of parcels at this time of year. And, you know, it was very important to the fact to the men, not just because of the extra food, but they could actually envisage their families eating Christmas dinner at the same time. And you see quite a number of references in letters, men saying, as I ate my Christmas cake, Mum, I could see you and Dad and brothers and sisters sat around the Christmas table eating yours as well. So it was a real connection between home and front. And the same, men derived a great deal of comfort from it.
Yeah, indeed, a sort of symbolic significance far beyond its food value. What are army rations like today? How do they compare?
Well, interestingly enough, the actual calorie level is almost exactly the same. It's just over 4,000 calories. Of course, the difference is, and I think the prime difference probably is the change in nutritional understanding of nutritional science over the last 100 years. The soldiers in the First World War were as much a victim of our understanding, or the understanding at the time, of what was important in a human's diet. The role of vitamins and minerals and trace elements, and indeed the need for real variety in a diet, was not understood at the time of the First World War. It was only just coming into our understanding. So, of course, on one hand, the army thought if it delivered 4,000 calories a day to a soldier, even if it was in the form day in, day out of a tin of corned beef and a packet of hardtack biscuits, it had done its job. Now, of course, the army realizes that men need a much more varied diet than that, with much higher levels, certainly of vitamin and trace elements, than were available, was understood to be necessary during the First World War. Having said that, some of the things, there were remarkable similarities. And one of the things I noticed, I was looking through one of the new all-climate ration packs that have just been introduced to deal with the hot climates in Iraq and Afghanistan, was that each pack contained a miniature bottle of Tabasco, hot sauce. And when I first saw it, I thought, oh my goodness, you know, what a modern globalized diet we all have now. But of course, when I look back, curry powder was an essential part of many First World War soldiers' individual private ration packs. If they couldn't get it on the ration, they bought their own supplies. It was used to make tins of meat or slightly stale fresh meat much more palatable. And though that came from the British Army's long experience out in India. So, you know, the need to flavour food, to spice it up, to make things more interesting, is interestingly enough, stays very much the same.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
We don't always realize just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger, talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
And thanks to Dr. Rachel Duffett, who teaches at the University of Essex. You can read her feature in the December issue of BBC History Magazine.
Thank you, Sue. This month, there is a major conference happening in London about the origins of the French Revolution. I talked to one of the conference organisers and speakers, Professor Julian Swan of Birkbeck College, about how we ought to understand the French Revolution today.
OK, Julian, you're organising a conference about the French Revolution in December, and the idea is to kickstart a debate about the origins of the revolution. But before we get into that, perhaps you could just give us a very brief overview of the basic nuts and bolts of what happened at the start of the French Revolution.
Right, well, I think a good way to understand it is to think that in 1789, France had one of the most important political crises in over 170 years. For the first time, the National Parliament, the Estates General, met in May 1789 amidst great hope and expectation. But it was also against the background of a very serious financial crisis, and also real problems, economic problems, that meant that bread prices, for instance, were higher in Paris than they'd been at any point in the previous 50 years. As a consequence, then, when the king, Louis XVI, failed to take the initiative at the Estates General, things rapidly unravelled. Many of the latent social tensions between the nobility and the commoners, who made up more than 98% of the population, came to the surface. And in the end, the acrimony between the nobles and the commoners, without the king coming in to mediate, led to a breakdown in relations. Ultimately, the Third Estate, the commoners, declared themselves to be the National Assembly. And that was a truly revolutionary movement in June of 1789. And that forced the king finally to act. What he did was to start to mass troops around Paris with the aim, one assumes, of establishing order once again. It was against that background, with high bread prices, great political excitement, fear, obviously, of what the troops might do as they came towards Paris, that the Parisian people began to seize arms. And, of course, the great highlight of that moment was on the 14th of July 1789, when the ordinary people of Paris and many rioting and mutinying soldiers stormed the Bastille. And that, for many people, is seen as the great moment at which the French Revolution began.
A moment of high drama when the Bastille was stormed. What exactly happened on that day? What were the events?
Well, what had been happening really over the previous two or three days is that the drama had been unfolding, largely because the king on the 11th of July had dismissed his popular minister, a man called Jacques Necker. That was seen really as a symbol of the fact that the king was about to begin this crackdown that I've mentioned. And as a consequence, then, the fears in Paris led to people rushing around to the main strongholds, such as the Tuileries, and also to particularly to the Invalides, where they were seizing weapons. They got those weapons and they needed the powder. And the Bastille was both a fortress, a prison, and also a store for powder. And so the mutinying soldiers, together with the ordinary men and women of Paris, went there with the aim of seizing the powder. And that really, in the sense, was the trigger, because the resistance they received, some shots were fired, some of the besiegers injured. And, of course, then that unleashed the anger of the crowd. And indeed, you can imagine the great euphoria when this symbol, the Bastille, which had been there for over 500 years, fell.
Mm-hmm. So in July 1789, we're in it. We're in the middle of society and revolution now. But what we need to do is we need to get back and find out why it happened. And so you're in the conference you're organising, you're looking to try and find a new way to understand that. But perhaps we ought to cover some of the older ways that people have looked at it. So. What are the conventional ways of understanding the start of the French Revolution and why it happened?
Well, the origins of the French Revolution is one of the great historical debates. And indeed, there have, as you might expect, over the last 200 years or so, been a great list of possible explanations that have been put forward. If we'd been talking 40 or 50 years ago, what we would have been concentrating upon would have been the social conflict, the struggle between the bourgeoisie and the old aristocracy. Mm. And we'd have thought about the origins of the revolution very much in terms of a class struggle. That interpretation really, you know, came into serious disrepute, I suppose, in part with the decline in the popularity of Marxism in the 1960s and especially the 70s and 80s. And from the 70s, historians talked a great deal about revisionism. The idea, to give you a couple of examples, looking at the aristocracy and arguing that, in fact, far from being the reactionary dinosaurs that the Marxists had once suggested, they were, in fact, many of them, to the fore in terms of promoting liberal ideas, whether politically or even intellectually. Similarly, the bourgeoisie, which had been represented by the Marxists as a rising class of what you might describe, I suppose, of grad grinds, of industrialists and commercial people, in fact, when under closer inspection, turned out, in fact, to be mainly the classic bourgeois of the French towns. Mm. They were lawyers and merchants, and especially lawyers. And so, in fact, then, the sort of class model didn't add up. And so there was a great concentration then on trying to explain not the deep-rooted social causes, but more the short-term political problems that had led to the breakdown of the regime. And I suppose since 1989, there's been, as you might expect, as part of the general popularity of cultural history, a greater concentration on the ideas, on the language, and on the, if you will, discourses that were changing as a consequence of events in the lead-up to the revolution and as part of it. Great emphasis on terms, for example, such as patrie or citizen, mm-hmm. republic, looking for the origins, if you like, of the intellectual changes that made a revolution possible. So there's some of the ways in which historians have been battling about it up till now.
So you're looking to move the debate on in the conference. You want to find a new way of looking at why the French Revolution started. So perhaps you could just enlighten us.
Yeah. I mean, I think what is important is to get back to basics and to have a look at what had caused the crisis in the first place. Too often, I think, there's the debate has become a sort of a general search for the origins of the revolution and not actually concentrating specifically on the problems that the state and indeed the government of Louis XVI faced. These were financial, diplomatic, and also political in the sense of trying to cope with the fact that the population, particularly the educated population, was that was a section that was growing continually throughout the 18th century as a consequence of increased wealth, of better education, and of a wider distribution of printed and other materials. It was getting much more difficult for the monarchy just simply to deal with issues without actually engaging with the population. What that meant, I suppose, and the old phrase springs to mind, there was a way in which the monarchy had got to engage with the population, had actually got to involve the governed in government, if you will. And I suppose, I say, we could almost say that it was a problem in terms of taxation, at least, of bringing in an element of representation. And so, in a sense, I think what we've got to look at is what had caused and what were the factors that were making the government unpopular with its subjects, and how did the king and his ministers think about solving those problems? And just to give you one example, the one thing that is very clear, throughout the reign from 1774 when Louis XVI became king until 1789 when he summoned the Estates General, there were continual attempts to involve the governed in government through things such as reforms of municipal government, attempts to establish provincial assemblies and administrations that would oversee local government, an assembly of notables, which was to summon, as you might expect from the title, various dignitaries from within the regime and its administration to advise on how government might be reformed. And finally, the Estates General itself, where it reaches out to the people as a whole for them to present their grievances to the government. So in a sense, what I'm saying is one of the key problems is how you identify the
the problems that the monarchy faced and how it tried to solve them by bringing the population as a whole into the equation.
So the government and indeed the monarchy was trying to bring the people into some sort of enfranchisement, I suppose. But what about Louis himself, Louis the 16th? Where does he sit in all this? Because I think in the feature that you've written for us, you mentioned that he was personally popular, but he didn't somehow manage to transmit that to the people to enable him to push through any reforms that he wanted to do.
Yes, Louis the 16th is a curious figure. I mean, first of all, as I say, if you're coming to the revolution for the first time, and I mean, know obviously that the unfortunate Louis would lose his head in the course of the revolution, and yet in 1789 he was genuinely popular. He was a monarch who was seen as restoring French liberty. Certainly, somebody who was seen, you know, in positive terms at the beginning of his reign. His problem, and I think he had several problems, but one of his principal problems was that he never capitalized upon that popularity. He struggled to break out really of the traditional Bourbon habit of being centered in his palace at Versailles or in a string of other palaces such as Fontainebleau, and very rarely made the effort to actually go into the kingdom as a whole. He once made a trip to Cherbourg to visit the military fortifications that were being put together there, and the trip was a great success. People flocked spontaneously to see him, you know, shouting, "Long live the king!" And he was absolutely thrilled by all of this and shouted back, "Long live the people! Long live my people." And there was really an opportunity for him, I think, to forge a more popular bond between the monarchy and the French population. In a way, perhaps, other monarchs were able to do elsewhere. Frederick II in Prussia is a good example. Or perhaps even in the early part of his reign, George III in England. So it's this attempt really to make the monarchy popular and to tie it also to an undeniable sense of French patriotism. So I think the king didn't take advantage of the assets that were there, his personal assets. I think he also suffered from a more, ultimately a more damaging problem, and that was his inability really to be decisive in government. It's known that, for example, he was very close to his minister Colon, who had been in government in 1783 to 1787, had been one of the principal reformers that the king had backed. The policies that Colon presented to an assembly of notables in 1787 had been worked out with the king. And yet, when Calonne ran into deep and persistent opposition, he was ultimately abandoned. Similarly, the king was strongly opposed to the recall of Necker, the minister I mentioned a few moments ago. He didn't want him back. He'd had him in government early before and decided that he'd been let down by him and didn't want him back. But he came under such pressure from the queen and from other members of the court, and indeed, more broadly, from public opinion to bring back this man who was seen as something of a financial genius, that he eventually relented. And so, in a sense, what you often get is a problem of a monarch who is actually having to go along with policies that he personally doesn't agree with. And I think that's one of his grave weaknesses.
So could he have played it better and saved his bacon and the place of monarchy?
Of course, it's always difficult, you know, to say, well, what if?
Yeah.
But undoubtedly, there's nothing inevitable about history. There was nothing inevitable about the revolution ending in violence, in terror, and indeed with the execution of the king. So, yes, he could have prevented it. How could he have prevented it? That obviously becomes much more difficult. But clearly, one of the things that stands out, especially in 1789, was his failure to take the lead. When the Estates General met, it had been convoked by Louis. It was there to present its grievances in 1789 and also to hear what the king was going to give to his people, what the king was going to propose for the reform of France. That was the moment when had Louis presented even quite a modest set of reforms, including, for example, regular parliaments, which is what people were hoping for, regular meetings of the Estates General, then I think it's clear that the offer would have been welcomed with open arms. He was popular, the idea of reform was there, and a strong lead from the centre would have been a real assistance. And it was the failure to provide that lead that created something of a vacuum. Into the vacuum flooded the Third Estate and the leaders of the Third Estate, men like Mirabeau, who had become famous later on. And in effect, once the control of events had been lost, the king never really succeeded in re-establishing any hold over them. He was always following events. And as that result, really, from then onwards, his chances of coming out with a settlement that suited him were slim.
Okay, just to finish up now, I think. Why do we still care? Why are we still talking about the French Revolution now? I mean, it's 200 years, more than 200 years ago. Why does it still matter?
Well, I think, obviously, you can look at it in a number of ways. The revolution for itself, I think, is undoubtedly one of the great events, important events in terms of shaping the future development of not just European, but societies worldwide. It had major impact on the way in which individuals, thinkers, politicians would think in Russia, China, elsewhere, throughout the last 200 years. So it's the importance as a historic event in itself, you know, is on question. It's also one, I think, that is important because of the fact that the implications of the revolution still, you know, have a certain resonance. What were we looking at in 1789? We were looking at a government that in many ways had benign intentions regarding to its population. Its population was becoming more educated, becoming richer, becoming wealthier, becoming more anxious to be involved in government. And yet, this rather authoritarian regime had got to try and marry this problem of maintaining its political and social control and at the same time dealing with the expectations of the population. Well, I don't think it would be too difficult to think of one or two other regimes currently in place where very similar things are still happening. You know, population, does it, you know, ring any bells if you start to think about China or Iran today? You know, societies which have very, certainly in the case of China, a very authoritarian government, but with a population that is changing in a remarkably rapid and significant way. So I think wondering about how regimes deal with the problem of change is one that is constantly of interest, and one that we can, I'm saying we can learn from necessarily, but you know, we should certainly reflect upon.
Many thanks, Julian.
So you can read a short feature on the French Revolution by Professor Swan in the December issue of BBC History magazine. And that conference, The Crisis of the Absolute Monarchy, is to be held at the British Academy in London on the 14th and 15th of December. You can find out more about that at the end of the feature in the magazine if you'd like to go along.
BBC History magazine is published each month. You can find it in all good newsagents in the UK for just £3.80. Or you can save money and make sure you never miss an issue by taking advantage of one of our great subs deals, whether you're in the UK or overseas. Details are on the website at www.bbchistorymagazine.com.
This is the end. Next time round, we'll have Samuel Johnson and a look at what drove the Viking invasions. Do listen in. I confidently expect it'll be good.
Collision between a Chinese jet and an American spy plane.
He came and rammed into our left wing.
With relations increasingly strained, what are the chances of things spinning out of control?
The Western world was asleep.
I'm Gordon Carrera. I'll be exploring the friction in this most important of relationships and asking, has the West taken its eye off the ball?
You cannot ignore China.
From BBC Radio 4, this is Shadow War, China and the West. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.